This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. For anyone who's gone brewery hopping in Denver, Colorado, you know how lively and enjoyable that can be in one of the U.S.'s preeminent beer towns. With multiple generations of brewers all working alongside each other, Denver has a brewing history and a status unlike any other. But if you're like me, you've also noticed that there's some common, and maybe too common, themes in Denver breweries. Lots of IPAs, a lot of outdoorsiness, and that sort of early 2000s don't try too hard aesthetic in the form of picnic tables and raw wood and concrete that passes for authenticity unquestioned among craft enthusiasts. And let's face it, some of it's real, some of it's not. So when True Brewing popped up on the scene, it was a violation of the sort of Pleasantville-like quality of the Denver scene in more ways than one. Founder Nick Nuns was making yeast-driven beers with a heavy metal theme and in a neighborhood far from the sparkle in Denver's eye. Much has changed since then, but mostly in ways that continue to put True Brewing at the edge of a still somewhat monoculture beer scene, as good as it is, with a few great exceptions. And in this next phase, founder Nick Nuns is going to make things even weirder. This is Nick Nuns of True Brewing. Listen in.
I met the guys, Lori and Porter from Smog City, at CBC in San Francisco back in like 2011, whenever that was. And I had my business plan mostly put together to the degree that that business plan was actually put together, which was not very.
Okay.
And it was entirely on premise, which now is a phrase, right? Everybody knows what on premise is. And like, I'm seeing it pop up over and over and over again.
For anybody who doesn't, on premise is sort of like this riff on premise, a term that we use for sales. Where you buy something at the place. Own premise is really about buying it at the brewery itself.
Right. Yeah. So like tap rooms and, you know, like retail establishments where you're selling your own beer. My business was based entirely on that. And, I think there was some, they quote the story and I don't remember this at all, but they were like talking about how I asked a question at some seminar about like whether or not you need to even distribute beer, whether or not you can run a business based entirely upon like having a tap room. And somebody on the panel that was like, giving this talk was like, I don't know if that would work. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, what? Now I'm looking back, I'm like, I didn't invent this, but like, how did people not see this shit coming like miles and miles away? Like, of course, like you literally all you have to do is sit down with a spreadsheet and you figure out that like, that's how you're going to fucking make a sustainable business.
And the opposite side of that is true. I mean, so there's a lot of debate happening right now between wholesalers and brewers around distribution rights and like what's fair to everybody to like maintain existence really. When it seems like momentum is obviously working in favor of breweries for the first time ever. Maybe
about
ever
time.
Since Prohibition. But now I'm starting to see the inkling of a conversation between retailers, bars and restaurants and breweries. Because in places where you have the ability to have multiple retail licenses as a brewery, retailers are essentially making the case, like now you're not just the special destination that people get to go to, which they supported, but now you're my competition.
Right, exactly.
And you absolutely are.
I think those guys are flagging really hard right now. I have one of the prominent beer bars in Denver, I won't name, but I was talking to the owner and he was like, yeah, we've had like three really shitty months in a row. And
we've got some vocal ones out there pushing back on it.
Yeah, exactly. And it probably was the same
one. There was a research project I did a couple years ago for a bar in Chicago. Really well-known craft bar, and he wanted to know, do I need to reconcept to compete with these other craft bars that are opening now, which are all like high concept craft bars? He's like, I'm just a normal like OG craft bar.
That doesn't fly anymore.
Yeah, he's like, do I need to reconcept and do I have an opportunity or is something else happening and I'm not aware? So we did a research project. I came back to him. I was like, oh, these other concepts are not your competition. They're your neighbors. Brewery tap rooms are your competition.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's like, 3 months later, he was close. He was like, oh, you're 100% right. I see the writing on the wall. There's nothing I can do to fight that momentum. Shut it down. Now he works for a brewery.
Damn, really? So he gave up on the whole thing.
Just pulled the plug, sold the place. It became a new concept craft bar that's doing really well.
So what is a concept craft bar that works now?
You know, like, right? It's probably got a... so I'll name a couple in Chicago, like Pub Royale is a great one.
Okay. Where
it's a phenomenal beer list, but it's also got great cocktails and wine. So it's a lot more inclusive.
Diverse, right? Yeah.
And the food has a really strong theme. So like if you're into like, they call it white boy Indian food. If you want those flavors, which are amazing, like you go there. Like,
yeah.
You've got a reason to go to that bar over something else.
Yeah, sure.
Hopleaf's been doing it forever because and it literally comes down to like Belgian muscles.
Yeah.
Like somebody comes to town, they're like, where should we go? And they're like, well, we could go to this bar or this bar or this bar, which are all the same. Mm-hmm. Or we can go to the Hop Leaf and get the muscles. They're like, well, that sounds like an idea.
Yeah, right. the Hop Leaf is a perfect example. I was listening to Beer Temple in like, you know, what, it's 25 years or something like that? And they're somehow, I went there in 2010 probably, and it's old school. It feels old school a little bit, right? From my memory, it's a long time ago, but you know, it feels like a classic beer bar, but somehow they're staying afloat and they're making a go of it, right?
And everybody around them is churning. Like those places don't stay open for more than a couple of years.
I really think that is, I mean, that's the whole package, right? That's having a well-curated list, good service.
We also put wine on draft a couple of years ago.
Smart.
One of the first people to do that.
Yeah.
Like it's just constant evolution.
Yeah.
It's the people who I see struggling the most are the people that struggle with the idea of change at all.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody, and I think that speaks to retailers and wholesalers and breweries as well. It's like nobody gets a mandate to rule any part of the system. Oh, yeah. Like you're all changing all the time and you got to keep up.
Yeah. If you're not reinventing yourself constantly, like you're not running up, like that is beyond beer, right? That's any business ever. If you're not reinventing yourself, like you're just not doing your job. Like you're not doing your job.
Yeah. That's you fall behind and then you start to develop the sense of entitlement for what you think you've earned and people have earned that place, but you've got to keep earning it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no laurels.
Yeah.
So retail has been important to your success so far.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Is it important to your future, to your growth? What does growth look like? Does it go beyond retail or does retail become, is that still kind of a critical piece of what you're doing?
I think, you know, our tap room is our bread and butter. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right. It's always going to be, at least in the past 5 years that we've been open, it's been, you know, the big business. And only, I would say last year, did we really start doing a lot of wholesale activity for our own beer. So it still is, it's the moneymaker for us, you know, and we've created a unique experience there where it's totally unlike any other tap room, maybe in
certainly
the
in
country, definitely in Denver. Right. So, we stand out, we're always, you know, cited as like, oh yeah, if you're going to Denver, like go here and go to True, you know, like that sort of thing. So, we're super lucky to have a really unique experience there where, we just like stick in people's brains. Mm-hmm. I still get people coming up that are like, oh, I went back there in like 2013 and it blew my mind. It was so crazy. Like it was so different. And just like, I couldn't believe this was happening sort of stuff. And it's just, it's always cool to hear those stories where it just like, it just dug right into somebody's brain super deep and they just don't forget about it.
Well, I mean, not to take anything away from Denver, I think it's earned like a really high place in the American sort of beer mecca as a beer town. But for a while, to me, it just kind of started to feel the same everywhere.
Yeah,
it's like there's very much a Denver brewery type.
Yep. Yeah. It's
more than most cities, I would say.
Yeah. I started calling them just another brewery.
Yeah.
You know, or it's just like you're going to this place and it's like it's got corrugated metal and Beetle Kill and like all the same aesthetic elements that you would see in
and
any other
beers.
Fucking tap room. Yeah. And the same beers. That's at the end of the day, that's the most important thing is it was the same beers everywhere. And it just got really, really boring, you know? So it's like, I think Denver's in a really weird state right now, as far as beer goes. And I think it's trying to figure, you know, I think we're going to have some figuring out to do. Mm-hmm. You know, now that I'm traveling a lot more, I'm getting out to see like all these other beer scenes and like what's cool here and what's working and what isn't. Mm. And, it's just amazing to see how different we are than some of the other parts of the country.
Absolutely.
Dock sales in Colorado just don't work.
Yeah.
There's literally one brewery I can think of that's actually pulling that off to this day. Mm. And, nobody else. You know, no matter what you're releasing, no matter what it is, like you're not getting a line out the door. You're not selling out a pallet of fucking beer in a
just
day.
Just not part of the culture there.
Yeah, it's just not. Nobody wants to line up for beer because it's everywhere, right?
Right.
So,
yeah, the ubiquity of it has kind of nullified that idea.
Yeah, exactly. It killed us in a way. It was a self-defeat. But
I mean, so you opened up. I mean, so there's all these kind of outdoorsy breweries making IPAs and big barrel aged stouts, and you were like the nerdy metal kids.
Yeah. Sitting inside in a shotgun bar. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's so weird that we're known for that, right?
Because
it's like mixed firm was only a thing for us probably in the past. Well, I mean, we started the program about a year and a half after we opened, you know, and like I said, we've been open 5 years now and it really only took off when we set up the Acid Temple. That's when we really, and even that only started turning around a year after we started brewing there. Right. Cause all that shit takes forever. So,
so what were the things you were actually making a living off of during all that time?
I would say that 2015 was one of the hardest years we have ever had. That was the year that we finished construction on the Acid Temple and started brewing there. And literally every every penny of profit we were making was basically getting funneled over to make more beer at Temple. Mm-hmm. So I did a really poor job of like cash flow planning on that whole thing where I was like, yeah, we're not just going to need these construction fees and like all this equipment, but oh yeah, we're going to need like all this fucking money to make all this beer over there. I didn't think about that at all, 'cause I'm a terrible business owner arguably, but, yeah, so that was, we were just struggling, and it was like the tap room was literally floating every single thing that was happening at Temple.
Yeah.
And we were just struggling to make it work. And then my head brewer, Zach, finally started messing around with Mixed Firm and Stainless a little bit and playing around with that. And he brewed Cursed, which has become our flagship. Mm. And as soon as he that beer turns around in, I would say, about 3 months. So from like, it's basically like a lager fermentation, you know, it takes about as long. And once he brewed that and showed that he could turn that around that quickly, I was like, that's what we're going to do. Like, that's the beer that we're going to start making, is like, we'll use that as our flagship beers. And we'll have a couple of these stainless beers that we can do mixed firm with. And mm-hmm. yeah, they'll take a little bit longer than an ale, or, you know, it's not IPA or anything like that, but it's a reasonable turnaround time. And, you know, we just started brewing that like crazy, and it took off, man. Yeah. It just, that was our success right there.
There was an interesting moment in your trajectory. I don't know if it's still true, but it seemed like you were more well respected and regarded and visited by people from outside of Denver than people who were actually local.
Yeah.
Like, it seemed like it took a little while. It took that sort of national attention in some ways for people locally to really start to think about you.
I would say that's true. And I would say that we still to this day tend to get better feedback, more positive feedback from people outside of Colorado.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. And that's not bagging on Colorado. I love our locals. We have super loyal regulars. So like, we have these people who would like lay down on their sword for us, which is unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I guess I think it's indicative of how early Denver developed as a beer town. It hit that mainstream audience faster than almost any other city.
Yeah, so fast.
And so you had everyday people just drinking pale ales and IPAs as their, you know, that was just their day-to-day beer.
Yeah.
Like, that was the success of that town, is they got to the mainstream faster than anybody. Yeah. And that's huge.
Absolutely.
But that can send the wrong kind of message to somebody who's trying to open up something kind of niche, to think like that you build it and they come. It's like, well, they don't come for mixed firm sour beers.
No, but they do now.
They do now. That's what it takes. It takes a little, if you're going to be that sort of niche and outside of the norm of that scene, you kind of have to compete for those customers from scratch.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, that, you know, the people going down to Great Divide for an IPA every day aren't necessarily looking for niche beer experiences. They're looking for another brewery experience.
Right.
That sort of fun lifestyle kind of thing.
And that's like, that is the perfect example of the, like, that would be the archetype for the Colorado brewery.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people literally,
they're my archetype.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that to me is Colorado beer, is Great Divide. And unfortunately they're not, you know, like, that's changing for them a lot. And I think people have gone past what Colorado beer is, and, you know,
niche is the new normal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I see that, and it's not unique to True. I see that happening in a lot of other beer towns that are, either developing newly, like now, for a beer scene, or they have that mainstream audience, but not necessarily niche audiences. We saw it with Chris Johnson from Green Bench, for example.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was trying, he was making all these pale ales and IPAs and pilsners, and then he went through the Shelton network with his mixed firm stuff because not enough people locally were buying it.
Right,
and then he caught a bunch of shit for saying, like, people here just aren't really into this yet. They're not ready. Like, but they will, you know, assuming they will be eventually.
But he seems to have, like, and now, like, you look at what's happening in Tampa and St. Pete, and it's just like everybody's crushing it.
Yeah,
like,
now they're ready.
Like, Justin and Seven Sun and all those guys, like, all these breweries are blown up and doing those sorts of cool concepts.
Yep.
And like, the market caught up with them. Yeah. So it's just like,
but there's that weird, awkward time period you're way ahead of the curve. You don't have the customers locally yet, but nationally, people are paying attention to those because those beer geeks are paying attention nationally. They travel a lot. They seek them out. They know where they're at.
That brings up, like, you need to know your market, right?
Yeah.
You need to know, like, who wants to buy this beer. So for us, it's like, I've been hearing all this stuff lately about, like, you need to own your local market.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's like, well, my local market is so fucking saturated at this point that, like, there's no way I can, right?
Yeah.
And also, I'm giving people an experience that they might fucking hate.
Mm.
They might hate. I've had people be like, I love your beer, but I can't fucking come to your tap room. So it's like, sorry, man. Like, we're just playing the music we like. Like, it's really not that abrasive. Like, and can sit far away from the speakers. Like, it's super easy to find
ironically,
a quiet
I find
spot.
Your tap room to be one of the most chill tap rooms in all of Denver.
Like, but for some people, people.
It's like, not crushed with a bunch of people like laughing and like yelling and like it's people that are in there for like a chill experience and just like let the music be the you know the atmosphere.
You're not gonna hear a lot of like woo at my brewery, you know. So it's like
that's exactly what I'm running away from when I'm leaving downtown Denver. Like, get me out of here.
No shit.
Just gonna go to this dark place and drink mixed burn beers and like talk quietly to the guy I just met next to me.
Oh shit, that's exactly how we met too. That was so perfect. Yeah, so it's like, I can't own my local market.
Right.
And the beer we're making is, you know, there are other options for what we're doing there. And we're pretty, you know, we get decent import too. So we're getting, you know, like breweries from other states bringing in their beer to Colorado. And CSA has helped with that a lot, you know, bringing in just a huge portfolio of like really interesting mixed firm, Saison, you know, all that sort of interesting stuff that we do.
Yeah.
So our market is pretty saturated. So I look at that and I'm like, I'm not going to own this local market. But I do have really transportable beer, and I have a brewery that looks like it should be going on tour anyway. So why the fuck don't we go on tour?
Yeah.
So I come to things like this and I'm like, yeah, we'll sell a pallet and like just hang out and like do some events. And like, yeah, that's great. We just sold a whole bunch of beer and then like pulse a little bit out to, you know, some other urban area. Yeah. So it's like for us, it's not about owning our local market. It's about finding what other markets are interested in what we're doing and understanding that like, because we're so niched both in our beer and our brand that we need to get the beer to the people who love it.
Yeah, it's a little extra effort, but it goes a long way.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
When you say travel ready or, you know, travels well, you're talking about the styles, the stability. I mean, this stuff kind of holds up on a shelf pretty well.
Yeah. If not,
it can wait to find its customer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it does, you know, like it's, this is not high volume beer. It's not velocity beer. You know, it's the sort of stuff that like, you buy a bottle every once in a while, you know, because you're like, man, I miss a Cursed or I miss a Life Straight or whatever it is.
It's like buying wine, honestly. It's the same kind of mode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. And that's the biggest thing. I mean, other than the obvious differences in branding and whatnot, like, yeah, like it is very much delicate, nuanced beer that you should have with a meal or when you just want to enjoy something that's like, you know, a little more subtle or what have you. You know, it's not your go-to beer for sure, but it's the thing that you get when you want to treat yourself a little bit, which... And totally cognitive dissonance from a metal brewery.
Yeah, yes and no. It's heady in some ways. And I think people underestimate how heady metal can be.
Yeah.
To me, it fits the mode. So talking about the business model of going deep in your local market, that's very much, to me, that strikes me as advice for somebody who wants to be like the next new Glarus, right? And he's trying, he's taking Miller, you know, he takes Miller Light handles with his beers. Like that's like, it's unbelievable. But that's a strategy for somebody who wants to make a lot of fresh beer and they want it to be fresh when you get it. Mm-hmm. And it has to be local to do that.
Right.
And they want to dominate and they want to control and protect those markets.
Yeah.
Right. So it's stable over time. But there's absolutely an emergent model that you're describing. And I've seen it with Off Color in Chicago. Mm-hmm. When they launched it, they had a little trouble, you know, sticking in their local market because people weren't ready for a Goza. This was before Goza became a household term.
No kidding.
They were making Troublesome, and it was weird to people. They didn't know how to describe it, whatever. They kind of hit that
wall
pretty
fast. Didn't they, like, rebrand that, like, three times, too? Like, well, they changed the descriptor or something,
instead of Goza, they changed it to Tart Wheat Beer.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could sell a wheat beer in the Midwest, no problem. So that changed everything. But then, as Goza became a term, they rebranded it and called it Lipstick, you know, Lipstick Style Goza, very specifically, because now there's a bunch of Goza nerds.
Right,
and, like,
exactly.
That's a new thing. But that's just them evolving and adapting and understanding where their customer is. But they also started sending half of their product into the domestic import market. So half of it was sold at home. Half of it was sold on, you know, places like, you know, Chicago, New York.
We get it.
Yeah. You guys get it. Like it started showing up in other places because they were doing what you were doing, which was, where are those customers for these beers?
Yeah. So it's a totally different model. You have like, I think there's like three main models I'm seeing right now for breweries, right? Okay. There's the large brewery that wants to get handles, wants to get taps, wants to get in front of everybody all the time. There's the new emerging, I would call it like the new East Coast model, where it's like, you know, four packs of 16-ounce cans with a sticker on it, you know, pretty much the same beer.
Mostly on premise.
Yeah, all sold right off the dock, right? Yep. And you can thank Treehouse for just totally destroying that model and crushing it on that and proving that that's a concept, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's breweries like us, where it's, you know, all about like spreading it out to where you know your consumers are.
Right.
You know, so it's like, we know that like urban centers are going to be the place where people are educated on beer, and you're probably a lot more likely to find some metalheads, right? So it's like, this thing will register with those people a lot easier. So if we go to Chicago at some point, we know we could like, I know that's a market for us, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't have to do it a lot. We just have to send a pallet every once in a while, or two pallets or what have you. And like, yeah, we're stoked on that. It'll go in, flood in. It'll all be sold before it even hits the ground. And then, you know, we come back in half a year. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What I hear in those three models, which I think is totally accurate, is I hear finding your audience, and I hear operational needs at the, like, kind of shaping each other.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, so the 16 ounce four packs at a place like Trillium or Treehouse, that is necessary from a, not just from a finding your audience perspective, but from what those beers are. Mm-hmm. They need to be bought and consumed really fast.
Yeah. Like that's, or at least that's got in the lifespan. Mail pretty quick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, throw them in the mail soon. Yeah. It's just a bunch of mail carriers showing up in line.
So line of task.
But those beers kind of, they create that they create a bit of that necessity as well, right? And then because of that, you're able to find a different kind of consumer that wants this product. Yeah. Same thing with yours. Like the shelf life of these makes it possible for them to go everywhere.
Yep.
Therefore, you're able to find those customers.
Yeah.
They kind of work together. And the people making, you know, trying to dominate their local markets, they're making high velocity fresh beers. Like they can survive for a couple of months, you know, and be super good. And so that's about how far that footprint can go.
Yeah.
What I find to be, when I see people making mistakes, you know, whether it's their model or finding the wrong audiences or whatever, is when they start to take the beers from one model and sell them in another.
Try to put in another. Yeah, exactly, right? And that's why all these regional breweries are they're struggling so hard right now. They're having such a hard time because they spread all this beer out into like 100 different markets or what have you. And then all of a sudden that all goes away because somebody else closer to them is giving them fresher, better product.
Yep.
You know, it's like, why would a Colorado brewery send beer to Chicago that is that high velocity, needs to be fresh type beer, right? It's not going to turn around fast enough for it to still be good. And the people in Chicago don't have that local connection to it, right? So it's like, what? I mean, why did you think that this model was going to keep just going and going and going and growing? You know, it's like, of course that was going to fall apart.
We talk about AB and Miller Coors not recognizing the craft shift fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, regional craft breweries are missing it too.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I mean, they're totally getting caught with their pants down in the exact same way, just faster.
They're getting it from both sides, right? So it's like they're not big enough to fight AB Miller.
Yep.
But they're too big to be as cool or what have you as like a brewery like True, right? So it's like they're in this weird nexus between the two things, and they're just like, I don't know which way to go. Like,
it's terrible.
I forget which one. I think it was Fort Collins Brewery or maybe it was, I forget. One of our local breweries recently decided they were just going to like stop distributing.
Oh, they pulled back.
And they just start doing like, we're just going to do a brew pub now. And I'm like, oh, genius. You're probably going to make just as much money if you focus all your efforts on that one experience where like you don't have to worry about if your beer is getting fresh. And if you're not selling all that beer and it's just sitting on a shelf out there, like what difference does it make? Why not just like
nothing
focus
you're gonna do
your
to
efforts
change
on
that.
It, what's
you
working.
You can't change that reality. So you got to change your model.
Exactly.
There's a couple of breweries in Chicago I know now that have production facilities in the burbs, and they're looking into options to just flip those into contract hubs, move into the city with a brew pub, and just start from scratch from a model standpoint.
That's amazing.
Because like, if you're thinking strategically and not emotionally, right, and you're not scared of all that, leaving all that behind, it's like, well, this is obviously the way forward to be sustainable and evolve.
Yeah.
The sooner you pull the trigger on that, the better. Yeah. Like you're only gonna cause yourself more pain by waiting.
Man, it's unbelievable.
But for people who have the footprint and the installation and the workforce installed to support that old model, like that's hard to pull off.
I can't. The last thing I would want to be right now is a regional brewery.
Yeah.
They are in such a tough spot right now where I see them struggling. And I hear people's stories about what's going on. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like,
well, what do you think is going to be? So eventually 5 years from now, you're going to be getting pinched by some other weird business model.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
what are some
of
the things you're seeing happen that you think might force you to change or evolve or do something?
I mean, like for us, I see so many breweries talking about getting into like the mixed firm game, you know, and it's like, you know, so what's the longevity in that?
Yeah.
Like, can we continue that? The other thing is like really just determining what we want. I think that's the biggest thing for us is just like, how big do we really want to get? Like at what point are we all just happy?
Yeah.
You know, like when is it enough? There's
going
to be
possible.
Yeah, I think so.
It's hard to define that.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's going to take soul searching and whatnot on my part and like talking to the rest of my people and my head brewer and everybody and being like, when are we happy? When are we good with this? You know, like, what do we want to do? So I think that's a big part of it is just knowing when to stop, you know, like be like, okay, you know, like we're making a profit, we're getting paid, we're pretty comfortable. Like maybe instead of investing in a tank, we start putting money in a 401k or like fucking do shit that regular normal people do, you know? So I think I think that's a big thing that breweries need to start thinking about a little bit more is like, when is it enough?
Yeah.
How big do you really want to get? We're all like, it seems like we're all pushing ourselves and pushing each other to just keep growing and being like, oh my God, this year we grew by this much. And like, we're just continuing to crush it and all that sort of stuff. And
well, that's,
there's going to be a point where you just got to be like, no, we're set. Like, we're feeling pretty good about this. This is just a sustainable business, you know? Like,
so tonight that hits on tonight at Blue Jacket, we're hosting a panel discussion about that I called Odyssey and Oddities. And the central thesis there is kind of what you're saying is there's a story being told about craft beer that's been being told for a long time. And then there's the story of your particular brewery. When does that align and when does that contrast, mm-hmm. right? Because not everybody feels defined by craft, quote
right.
unquote,
right? right?
They feel defined by something more unique to themselves.
Yeah.
And the more competitive the market gets, the more important that is to know what that difference is.
Yeah. I think craft is dead.
Yeah, well, the story of craft forever, to your point, has just been grow, 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 grow.
Yeah.
And that's been very much a top-down message that I don't know if people realize how often those messages, when if you come to CBC and 4 days of presentation are about growth, you walk away from that thinking like, I need to grow. That's, this is what a craft brewery is. This is what we do.
Right.
We grow.
Yeah.
You don't realize that that's overriding your own sense of self and your own personal goals and what makes sense for you as a business.
Yeah.
Because it just becomes like this mantra.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, all 20,000 brewers are walking out with the same mantra.
Right, right. And I mean, like, I don't know what the BA's motivation is behind that of being so...
Leverage. they're a legislative group. And in order to have leverage in a legislature, you need to have money.
Yeah,
and
that makes
people.
Sense. Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense to me.
I knew it was going to get shot down, but I submitted a proposal for last year's CBC that was basically why you shouldn't do this. And it was almost like I wanted to come at it from a, you know, from that obviously dumb comedic spin, but at the same time being like, you know, like, this is not just like, it's not homebrewing.
Yeah.
This is a fucking business that you're running where people's livelihood depends on you succeeding and doing a good job. Right.
Yeah.
So like, I have had people keep comparing me to Henry from Monkish because we're just very vocal about like, this job can kind of fucking suck quite a bit. You know, like, it really is hard and it's incredibly taxing, and you're not always going to have a great time just sitting around drinking beer. You are going to have those moments for sure. And I love what I do, but I would never, whenever somebody tells me, hey, yeah, I'm opening a brewery, I'm like, talk to me first. Like, let's have a beer and like talk about like what the actual bullshit you're going to have to deal with is, you know?
Yeah.
So I submitted that proposal and obviously got shot down, even though I had like, I think it was like Gene from Tired Hands and like, I think Mike Sardino was going to talk on it as well. And it was just like, it's a really great panel of like people who are like well-respected in the industry, but it's kind of like the cautionary tale of like, get ready.
I mean, that panel also strikes me as quite young compared to who they usually put out there to speak for those seminars.
But I mean, how many breweries are actually old and big at this point? Like what percentage? Like 20%?
Not even.
At 4, like 5,000 plus
breweries.
It's
the 80-20 rule. You know? It's like 20% is making 80% of the beer.
Yeah, exactly.
I think in this case, it's even more skewed than that.
Exactly.
But for me, that brings up a central question of like, does an organization that is essentially working in, you know, their intent is to work in the favor of everyone, but they mostly end up working in the favor of the people who are pushing
the
hardest, have the most money, like have the, you know, they have the biggest needs.
Yeah.
Like, can it represent adequately or adequately include people that are 2 to 3 years old in this business, have completely different emergent business models that are competing with everybody else in that room?
I don't know. I really don't. And that's why I say craft is dead, because it's like, it's not about craft beer anymore. It's about like, we're all just making beer.
Yeah.
And like, we have so many diverse arrays of models that it's like, what, I mean, really what?
They're all just unique small businesses that happen to make beer.
New Belgium is a brewery that I love and respect first and foremost, but they are a fucking massive brewery.
Yeah.
Right. I have almost nothing in common with them. Almost nothing in common. We make a couple of things that are fairly similar, but like everything about what they do is so wildly different.
Mm-hmm.
And how can an organization really represent both them and us at the same time? I don't know. You know, like it could be possible. I'm not trying to bag on the BA. I respect them highly, and I think that they do, you know, important work for us.
But. Well, I'll say that. I mean, the Cantwell speech this week was the first time I ever heard anybody stand up there and adequately talk about some of the things that were relevant to a brewery like you. Because he was able to, like, he looked at both, like, you could tell he's stretching right now
yeah.
to wrap his mind around how diverse these businesses are.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of acknowledged it. And then I think he spoke to both, you know, there was some dog whistling in there a bit.
Yeah.
And he was trying to tell the big guys, like, you need to recognize that your industry is changing. He's telling the little guys, you need to recognize that these guys have made this possible.
Yeah.
And he was trying to, you know, he was speaking in a very inclusive and aligning kind of way.
And he would know, I mean, he's seen it all at this point, right?
He really has. Like, I mean, he did everything except say the words Hill Farmstead when he described a brewery a couple hours off of a dirt road in Vermont.
Oh, shit. That's funny, man.
And I think that's probably the first time I've ever heard anybody in a position of leadership even talk about a brewery that way,
mm-hmm.
you know,
to the rest of the
brewing world, which is made up of some of these larger, more industrialized breweries that are still very much craft in their origin.
Yeah, in their origin.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you walk around like some of these larger breweries, it doesn't feel like craft.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anybody stirring a mash paddle. Like right. I see pipe fences and I see like 600 barrel unitanks out front, right. you know, and all this
stuff.
They
were founded at a time when there was still only one idea of what a brewery was, and that's a factory.
Right.
And so they started very small, but they started by building very tiny factories.
Yeah.
And that's because that was just the model. Like that's the only thing you could conceive of when you thought about, well, what happens when we're bigger? And it's like, well, we're a bigger brewery.
Yeah.
But now when people think of like, well, what does growth mean to us? They're thinking about tap rooms
right.
or, you know, unique distribution opportunities and like then, or they're, you know, they're buying farms and like hosting and doing hospitality on farms and doing table dinners. And
it's so diverse.
Yeah.
The playing field is so diverse at this point.
'Cause it seems like growth now is a lateral thing. It's like, what other tertiary things can I do that relate to my business or my, you know, my ethos or the things I'm interested in mm-hmm. beyond just making more beer.
And it's the things you're interested in that will gain you success, right? Like, I think as long as you're doing the things you're interested in and you're not just doing them because they're a business opportunity or because it's like the thing to do or expected of you or what have you, like that is the way you succeed, right? That's the ultimate thing is like, you need to be true to yourself and you need to actually understand that like, this is what I want to be doing. Mm-hmm. Thus, I will have a passion behind it to do it well.
Right.
You know, so.
And I think it opens you up to growth through things other than making more beer.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And I think part of that is just the market constraints, right? Like I'm somebody who's convinced that most of the opinions we hold are actually forced upon us by our environment. like there's a reason old people talk about the weather and it's because it makes your bones hurt, right? Like it's not because they're fascinated by the weather.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's similar. Like the people who are now having ideas that are these very lateral thinking ideas, very associative ideas of how to grow a business and do other cultural things and interesting things and mm-hmm. getting into hospitality and food and, you know. One of the reasons they're thinking that way is because the market is forcing them to find another way to grow without making more beer.
Yeah.
Like how, and so then the question becomes, well, how do I make more money from the same amount of beer?
Mm-hmm.
Or how can I support this through another sort of tangential business that's, you know, that's related in some way?
Yeah. Or just even just understanding the core business of making the beer itself, right? It's like, we know we can only brew a limited amount of beer because of our system size and because of our square footage, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
So like, how do you make more money doing that? You make mixed firm beer or something like that, right? So it's like you understand that like, it's we're constrained by this thing, thus we will do this instead, which will end up being a higher revenue generating sort of concept, you know?
So. One of the things you're doing that I think is fascinating is not only are you exploring these kind of interesting like container or pallet drops for your distribution of your own beer, the kind of temporary market entry thing, but you're bringing in other people's beer into Denver.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about for you?
Hanging out with my buds. I mean, like, seriously, that's all it is. Everybody wants to make this out to be like this big business decision that I'm making where it's like, you know, they're saying like, oh, like, have you talked to Chad and CSA or have you done this and that and the other thing? And it's like, really, it came from me wanting to put Burial beer in my tap room.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I could do that with the right licensing and whatnot. So I was like, it's inexpensive. I might as well drop this coin now, do this, get this license.
Mm-hmm.
And see what happens. So we brought in the Burial beer, we put it on tap, we got crushed that night. Everybody was super stoked.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talked to, you know, Jess and Doug and everyone over there, and I was like, whenever you're ready, you can send us more beer. Like we can now literally just sell it whenever you want. So you got a little, like, you want to shave some off the top that's just like sitting around or something, or like, you know, maybe you got a couple of brands you just want to pulse out our way. You want to come out for GABF and pay for a plane ticket? Like, sell us some beer. Like, we can sell that out. We'll make a little bit of money. You'll make the money you need to pay for your travel and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
We can all hang out and have a party. That's all it is. I mean, it's really just hanging out with people.
No, I love that. I mean, I think the purity of where that starts and like the instinct there makes perfect sense to me. Eventually you're going to like that. you can only stretch yourself so far as an operator, right? As somebody that's like managing the, you know, all the different pieces of your business. Mm-hmm. And eventually you're going to look at that and be like, this is growing a little bit. Like,
it'll
this
be is a actually, viable thing.
Yeah. It this, could is a, grow this is another that. Leg on this weird stool.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, every time that's how I approach business in general is like, I recognize like, okay, this got big. You know, like I need a head brewer now. Like I need somebody to just make the beer. Okay. This got like, I can't do all these sales and do all this stuff. So sales manager, mm-hmm. you know, and then it'll be like the same sort of thing where it's like, we grew our in-state sales and out-of-state sales to a point where I was like, okay, now we need a in-state dedicated salesperson who's been fucking crushing it. And then my, you know, sales manager, Kat, she's just managing him and doing all our out-of-state sales. Yeah. And eventually she might be, you know, she's also managing talking to those breweries.
Yeah.
So she worked with Burial and the Commons and all those breweries that we brought in recently and just were like, she handled it. So it's like, I'm kind of sitting back and like putting all the pieces together and making sure all the gears are like working right. And like, yeah, I'm delegating, you know, like a fucking business owner should.
But you're doing it in an emergent way, which is actually, I think it's very similar to the way that like my own business has grown. Like mm-hmm. you started this thing and then you have to find a way to support it.
Yeah, you let it get out of hand.
Yeah.
And then you find somebody else to fix it for you.
And that's how Austin Ray got in charge. And then we started doing these festivals like Uppers and Downers. It's like, oh, somebody should be working on that better than
full me. Full time, yeah, right? Like you realize it's gotten to the point where it's like, okay, like I can't do this very well anymore. I created the seed of a concept and now it's big enough where I need somebody else to just fucking do it 100% of the time.
I remember when we hired a couple of folks and they asked the question of like, well, who's in charge of what? And I was like, oh, and I just started like, I was like, we have this piece and this piece and this piece. And these are the people that support that. And when I was done, I was like, holy shit, I just made an org chart. I've never looked at it that way before.
You corporate motherfucker.
But it was the first time I realized that like, ignorantly through an emergent need, like we created structure.
Yeah.
Right? And like everybody was working that way, just organically.
But yeah, that's organically is the way, right? Yeah. Like that's exactly it.
If I would have set out to make it that way, I don't think we would have ever gotten there.
Sure.
And because of that, we have this really interesting, weirdly shaped business.
Yeah.
That works.
Yeah.
Because it's there to feed itself.
But I think that's
not
it.
Not to adopt the structure of whatever came before us.
Sure. You can very successfully set up a business that has a predefined structure. Where it's like right off the bat, you're just doing a great job of running that business with all the people in place right from the start, right? Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly viable.
But I think you can only do that by mimicking the businesses that came before
sure.
you.
Yeah, you're not going to be as innovative necessarily, yeah. right? Like you might have an innovative product, but like ultimately you're going to be running your business the same way.
Yeah.
And I think
what makes something successful today is not just the product, but how you sell it, how you talk about it, where it shows up, like who are the people.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, that has to emerge a little bit.
Yeah, and that's been our whole... Like, I don't have this, like, long-term vision for anything we're doing. I might as well be looking directly at a wall with my nose on it. I'm like, I'm not forward-thinking like that. I'm just not, my brain is not set up to be like, this is where we're going to be in 5 years. When I see people talking about, like, we have our business plan written out for 5 years, I'm like, that sounds ridiculous. Mm. Like, I'm just kind of feeling shit out. And, like, maybe it's, you know, I've seen some success that way. Maybe I should be trying to project forward a little bit. And like, I'm thinking about the big picture and trying to look forward, but like, I don't have a business plan written out for 5 years. I don't have all these ideas that are like predefined. And I know that in like, you know, 6 months, we're going to do X, Y, Z.
Right.
It's very organic. And I think that has been a big part of our success, you know, is like just feeling out these opportunities and seeing where it goes. The only reason we're distributing out of state in the first place is because the fucking BA guys invited us out to Extreme and like we got set up with a distributor out there and we sent them enough beer that I was like, holy shit, we just made enough money to play for our plane tickets. Oh my, okay, I get this now. Like I understand. Okay. You know, and it's like, I'm kind of an idiot. I figure this shit out over time. And it's like, yeah, that's what it took for me. It's just organically like figuring out these concepts and like,
It's hard to develop a concrete plan for the future when there's not a lot of people you can look at that are doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of models.
Especially when what we're doing is in such a ridiculous state of flux right now.
Right.
And it's like, how am I supposed to project this? I mean, like, and I keep saying that if anybody's making like New England style IPA outside of New England right now, you kind of missed the boat already.
Mm.
And it's like, if you're hedging your bets on that one style, what if that falls just as quickly as it rose, you know? Like, what if all of a sudden the bottom just falls out of that whole thing?
Well, it's not even just people outside of that area. It's the people building giant production facilities in that area now off the back of that success.
Yeah, I mean, like, how – I think most people would argue that some of those beer styles are not the most shelf stable.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
How, I mean, that's how do you sell 50,000 barrels or whatever, that Trillium or, you know, some of these bigger guys, you know, like, how do you do that on premise and keep it fresh and keep that a sustainable thing? I would love to talk to them and be like, wow, how are you going to do that? Like, I want to know, like, I'm not criticizing that model. I'm just like, really? Like, you're going to make that much of that beer?
If somebody can figure out how to even get a month of shelf stability off of those, it'll be a big deal.
Yeah.
But that's going to have to be, that's the nut they got to crack.
Yeah. I don't get it. I really don't. I think that is a model for small breweries.
Right.
And if you try to keep growing
that's what we were talking about before, is like people trying to sell fresh high velocity beer, like in the old model, sure. and then spreading it all over the country and realizing like, oh, it's fresher here.
Yeah.
when it's being made in this town, realizing that they're selling the wrong product. The right product, the wrong model.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
The same can happen in reverse. You can start with that very small, you know, 16-ounce 4-pack, super fresh New England style IPA model and have it work.
Yeah.
But as soon as you try and sell it in a different way, it's going to fall apart
a little bit. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. 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 It's not built for that right. at all. So.
But I got to imagine that you're traveling more than ever. It seems. Mm-hmm. It's part of like this.
It's part exhausting.
It is exhausting. But it's part of the distribution tactics, you know, that you're exploring right now. Mm-hmm. It's a discovery period for you.
Yeah.
I got to imagine that's getting you inside of other breweries that helps you think about what you're doing in a different way.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Absolutely. And talking to these people, meeting them and like, exactly, man. It's like, that's such a huge, like, if I can make recommendations for people who are in the industry, it's like, maybe it's specific to our model because we are actually making a product that we need to move out to other places. But I do think that our travel has really inspired us in a lot of ways. We've met amazing, amazing people through this. And we've like, just having beers and bullshitting with some of these guys come up with new ideas and they come up with new ideas. And it's like, I feel like there's this really core group of tiny breweries that are on this like cusp that all talk to each other. They all hang out. And us getting into this like East Coast sort of scene a little bit has helped us immensely for like getting in with some of those guys and meeting them and like becoming friends with a lot of these breweries. And it just inspires you. It just keeps you continually looking, you know, continually thinking about what you're doing and seeing what else is out there and what other opportunities are.
I would imagine it gives you a productive way to channel the anxiety that you walk around with in your, you know, a lot of people don't realize that people running some of these small breweries where it's just like a breakneck speed all the time trying to keep up. Like you're inside your own four walls constantly.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really hard to get out and experience and sort of pollinate these different ideas.
The more you get to travel.
Yeah. The more
even
you get
in
to travel,
our local
the more
market.
You engage with that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the biggest disservice you can do to yourself as a brewery owner is to not go to other breweries. You know, you need to know what the hell else is going on out there.
Right.
You know, so if you're just sitting around in your four walls all the time, that's great. You might hone in your product to be really, really good, but like, what happens when that product becomes irrelevant and you're finding that, you know, like how else do you know that nobody else is buying it other than looking at like what's happening in your own tap room or.
It's fascinating to me to hear you talking about a product becoming irrelevant because I feel like in the past that took 20 years for people to realize. Now it seems like.
Like less than a year.
You're
talking about Goza anymore? Like fucking people are still making Goza? Like we made a Goza when we opened 5 years ago and now it's like, it's gone. I don't feel like a lot of people are making it. Berliner was a big thing, right? Like, who the fuck is making Berliner anymore? It just keeps shifting so fast where I'm just like, you got to keep up. Like, you got to be paying attention to this shit because all of a sudden you'll be like, it's like if a big regional brewery were actually working, the biggest disservice they do is having that sort of model where they market test all this shit and everything where they're like, this is big. They find out about it. And then they actually have to spend like 2 years developing the product. And then they launch it. And it's like, nah, man, you missed it. Like that shit is bunk. Like nobody wants that anymore.
Yeah. The time frame won't support that
exactly.
at all.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, that's the biggest disservice you have for being a big brewery right now is like, if you're not just doing shit instantaneously, you're not keeping up with that zeitgeist at all. So,
I mean, man, what a challenge.
It's so hard. That's why I'm like, I'm so glad I'm not that. Like,
well, there's so when you stopped by here before we got started, Oliver and Brian were here and we were talking about how brewers, I think like second generation brewers, like the meme, the thought meme that you hear them say all the time is we make beers that we like to drink.
Yeah.
And like, I believe them. I believe they like those beers, but I also believe they're trying to make beers that people want to drink.
Right.
Because they're growing and they need, you know, they're 50,000 barrels and that's a dangerous position to be in if you're not market ready.
Right.
I can't imagine you ever saying, I just make beers I want to drink, because that's a static idea. because somebody like you is on a very similar discovery process as today's geekiest drinkers. Mm-hmm. Like, you're constantly drinking new things and discovering them for yourselves and then getting inspired and wanting to make those. So what you like to drink and what you like to make is constantly shifting also.
Sure. If I were making the, if we were making the beers that we like to drink, like for me right now, like I actually like New England IPA.
Yeah.
Like, I find those beers to be somewhat enjoyable. I find them to be fairly similar.
Yeah.
I don't see a lot of breadth in that style necessarily. Fair, yeah. Maybe my palate's just not built for that. I don't know. But
no, I think they're by their nature. Pretty,
you know, they're all Citra, mellow. Amarillo, yeah. You know, Galaxy. It's all the same shit. But they're all good, and I like them. But we're not going to make them.
It's too late.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, exactly. Also, we don't have a facility that's big enough to support it.
Right.
You know, we can't make clean beer that big. We fucking make 7 barrels of beer
right.
at our tap room of clean beer. And then all of our large format, like our big fermentation space is all dedicated to the mixed ferm stuff at this point. And there's no going back from that. So, yeah, I don't see us jumping on that. So, yeah, we make some of the beers we like to drink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we start brewing a pils because we have always wanted to fucking make a pils because we actually like to drink a pils.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not part of our, it's not our ethos.
Right.
You know,
right.
We make a Belgian golden strong ale.
Mm-hmm.
I never fucking drink that beer,
mm-hmm.
you know, personally, but we sell it like fucking crazy at our tap room. So it's like, yeah, you got to understand what people want, what you want, and balance those two things out in some way where it's like, yeah, we are making the beers we like to drink, but we're also making the beers that everybody else wants to fucking drink. Cause at the end of the day, it's a business and like, we got to sell beer.
So you mentioned like the mixed ferm thing. I mean, you've been enjoying maybe the fruits of that labor for a year.
Yeah. A year or two.
Yeah. You're kind of finally comfortable with that from a business standpoint. Like it's working and you're finding unique models to sell it and distribute it, which is great. But as you mentioned, it seems like that's the term on everybody's lips right now for the startup brewery is mixed ferm.
Yeah. Well, for now. But
every
brewery that's opening right now is also putting in a cool ship, right?
Right.
So 3 years from now, you're going to be seeing Method Goods or,
Lambic
style beers.
But 5 years from now, are we going to be looking at True and hear you saying, like, I just make the beers I like to drink?
Yeah, I hope not.
And you haven't changed? Or are you looking at, like, what is the next evolution of your brewing, actually,
so
your
beer? Zach, my head brewer, Kat, my sales manager, and I sat around yesterday morning in our Airbnb and had like a 2-hour conversation of like, what are we doing? You know? And Zach was like, I like making these mixed ferm beers, but like now that I've done them well,
mm-hmm.
what else do I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a very introspective brewer, I would say, where he's continually trying to improve his own craft. So he's like, you know, I kind of want to like just brew some really solid Saison.
Mm.
You know, I want to try something else,
mm-hmm.
just do something else. And I was like, whatever you want to do, man, I trust you. Like, I trust him implicitly to make beer that is fucking top notch,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's my job to figure out, like, okay, how do we market it?
Mm-hmm.
How do we sell it? You know, what do we do with it at that point? So we are continually looking at what we're doing and being like, what is next? You know, like, how do we continue to evolve and continue to stay relevant? And we're not just like resting on our laurels at all and like just sitting around going to brew mixed ferm beer forever and ever and ever. There will always be a market for this, I think. I have seen, you know, like sour beer, mixed ferm beer, whatever you want to call it. Anything that's not a kettle soured, you know, goes a Berliner type thing has been around for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen it necessarily rising meteorically in the way that other styles may or may not have.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there will always be this undercurrent of that. Where these are, you know, hard beers to brew, to keep a sustainable business model with as your sole revenue earner.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it'll necessarily ever like do that like wild swing that all these other styles do. No,
otherwise we're gonna see the market flooded with a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I am keeping an eye on that, and I think about that a lot. Is like, okay, like what is the longevity of the mixed ferm stuff? Like.
Mm-hmm.
Does it become just one slice of the pie? Does it become like we just keep ramping it up and up and up and up? What do we do with that?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, combining those kinds of questions, like what you want to make just as a curious brewer, right? Which is probably just as inspired by your brewing background as your drinking mm-hmm. background and like what you like to drink right now.
Right.
But combining that sort of those big questions of what's next with the desire to find a comfortable place as a business in your mm-hmm. growth trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of those can be aligned or at odds with each other, depending on like how self-reflective a person can be about their own business. Because what we've seen from a lot of folks in the past is one of the ways in which they satisfied their curiosity, because they didn't have the ability to make a bunch of unique beers all the time, was the growth of the business. Like, it's fun to grow a business. Like, it challenges you in weird ways. Mm-hmm. You have to discover new ways of solving problems. Yeah. And that was kind of the curiosity. You're not necessarily in a position where you can look at the growth of the business as being the most fun part, right? Or like you're thinking about, where do I find that plateau that I like and that supports us and we're all happy.
Exactly.
That could get boring if you're not thinking about how that impacts your product and what you get to make every day.
Well, what can get boring? What specifically do you mean?
Everything. It all. like so you find that happy spot and you're like, cool, I just need to make mixed firm for the rest of my life.
That's why I feel like so many businesses in general just break shit. Yeah. So that they can fix it again, right? Like that's part of being a business owner is like maybe you break things. Like, we had a perfectly good thing going at our tap room, mm-hmm. and we could kind of keep up okay. And like, we were doing some of the mixed firm stuff at the tap room. We had the barrels like lined up right there. I actually preferred the aesthetic back then when we had those barrels there, because it looked fucking great. And it was working. It was fine. We weren't getting paid great, but we were doing okay. You know, it was sustainable. And then banks started coming and being like, we'll drop cash in your lap. And I was like, okay, you know, and I broke it.
Yeah.
I broke it. I built the acid temple and broke the model. So then I had to figure out how to fix it, you know? So I think a lot of businesses go through that sort of process where it's like, everything's working fine. And then you fuck it all up by trying to grow it or do something different or change it or what have you.
Well, that's the side effect.
But then it's good too, right? Because that helped us start doing this shit.
Sure.
Which now I'm in DC, you know, and it's like, now I'm hanging out here at the Craft Brewers Conference. Now people keep coming up to me being like, you guys are crushing it right now. And like, it's all because of that breaking the business and building it back up again that led to that. You know,
I mean, that's the side effect of finding a comfortable place is, for, you know, 3 or 4 years, you've been working like a fucking maniac.
Yeah.
Like, you lose the ability to be comfortable. And I could say this from my own personal experience. Like, when you start a small business and you're hustling like an insane person, you don't sleep and you're like up at 4 a.m. jotting down notes and like, you can't be comfortable. You lose the ability. It's like PTSD. You lose the ability to relax and enjoy something. And so if you reach that point, which is potentially a goal, you're still going to have all this energy and anxiety that has to go somewhere. And so what do you do? Hopefully you can invest that back into that energy, into making new kinds of beers or exploring your business in different ways that are satisfying, that aren't necessarily about growth and creating an unsustainable situation.
Yeah. I think it's recognizing when you have those sparks of inspiration and knowing when you have that moment of like, I know when I need to work on certain things, you know, like I'll have this, like, this pang of something where I'm like, I need to do creative right now. I need to write some copy because I just had this moment of inspiration. I was talking to Erin over at Burial, and she is really good about like laying out all their social media in advance. And I'm like, I can't fucking do that. I do all of our photography, all our social media, all that sort of shit. I can't just like take all these pictures in advance. It has to hit me in the moment. And I have to be inspired to want to take that picture or want to write that copy or put that post up, what have you.
Yeah.
Anytime I try to put up something like in advance or like plan something out as far as that stuff goes, it almost always falls flat because it's like I don't know if it comes across as disingenuous. I don't know if it's just because I don't have that creative inspiration in that moment, but it's almost 100% of the time when I try to plan those posts out that they don't necessarily go that great.
Well, it probably has a different tone than people are used to. Yeah. I mean, your brand has an immediacy to it for that reason. Like, you know that you thought about it in that moment and it's interesting to you in that moment.
Sure.
There it is. You're
genuine.
You're using it like the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But that's also the difference. I mean, Erin's in a very different role. Like, her personal identity is not wrapped up in that brewery in the same way that yours is.
She's so fucking lucky. It's like, I have wrapped myself so deeply and woven myself so deeply into what True is that there's no way I can ever give it up. Like, I can't hire a social media manager. I can't do that. It literally is just my voice. I've never really put on a persona. I've never really like known what the voice of True is. It's me.
Yeah.
I'm just saying this shit. I'm waxing dumb about like what the fuck ever we're doing at the moment, you know? And, I think it's that genuineness has really led to a lot of our success as far as that goes. You know, people will always come up to me like, I love your brand. I love like what you guys do. And it's just because I'm just being me on the internet, you know, like that's all I'm doing is just like talking about the shit that's interesting to me or like, holy shit, look at this fucking new beer. I'm so fucking stoked on it. You know, like, oh, we got this badass new piece of merch. Like, hey, I'm excited, you know? So I think that that excitement, that genuineness and that, all of that comes through, in such a way where it just feels natural to people. It doesn't feel like a cobbled together brand or anything like that. It just feels like a bunch of people who are hanging out doing their thing. The only thing that works against us is I met one of our vendors yesterday. He was like, oh, you're way nicer than I thought you guys would be, which is so fucking perfect. I'm like, yes, that's great. If there's one like weird veil that I put over everything, it's that we're a bunch of badasses when we're actually just a bunch of fucking dweebs like hanging out doing our thing. It's so perfect. Everybody is always so nervous to meet us. And we're like, hey, man, what's going on? And they're like, I didn't expect that.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This week we published a story from Brian Roth about Iceland's beer scene, which he summarized as, if Americans eat shit, we'll eat shit too. IPAs, man. We also published an op-ed on the value of independence from Upland Brewing Company's CEO, Doug Dayhoff. His point being that the customer will care about independence when we make it demonstrable in their lives, and not just a talking point. And Stephanie Bicey gave us a look at Michigan's ridiculous Dark Horse Brewing, which is slowly expanding horizontally instead of vertically in every conceivable way. Our podcast is supported in part by our Patreon subscribers, which include pro-level contributions from Hops and Grain Brewing in Austin, Texas, and Cloudwater Brewing in Manchester, England. You can become a supporter, which comes with loads of perks, by visiting patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.